My guest, Phong Bui, is an artist, writer, curator, and the co-founder, publisher, and artistic director of the Brooklyn Rail, a widely revered monthly arts, culture, and politics journal. Bui was born in Hue, Vietnam, a city which was the capital of the Nguyen Dynasty from 1802 to 1945, and which in 1968 was the site of one of the bloodiest battles of the Vietnam War. After the war, Bui's family was evicted from their home and relocated to a labor camp for re-education. After 2 years, they escaped to Malaysia, from which they moved to the United States, where Bui learned English by watching television, took his GRE in lieu of attending high school, and studied at the University of the Arts in Philadelphia with the goal of becoming an artist designer in the mold of Alexander Lieberman. After graduating, Bui went to New York City for interviews with companies such as Hallmark Cards and Condé Nast. Between appointments, with some time on his hands, he visited the Museum of Modern Art, where an encounter with Woman One by Willem de Kooning changed the course of his life. Speaking of this moment, Bui has said, "I saw de Kooning's Woman One, and it really gave me a shock. I got goosebumps. I had just read James Joyce's A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. Joyce talks about epiphany, not the profound religious sort, but the kind of awareness and free reception of everyday events, insignificant events, that somehow push you to some other direction in your life." Phong, what was it specifically about that painting at that moment that had such a profound impact on you?
I think the best way to describe it is like when you walk into a room where you'll be introduced by someone at the door and you saw behind there's someone sitting. What he called is a frozen glimpse. He wanted to paint that frozen glimpse. And to me, frozen glimpse happened to us all the time. We just don't pay attention that much. And why is it a certain glimpse catches our attention, certain don't? So for me, confronting that painting was so profound because I remember growing up in Vietnam, I saw a lot of glimpses running away from a certain horrible incident. Being a child, I remember during the Tet Offensive, 68, my father carrying me on top of his shoulder, running directly to the temple because the temple was one sacred space that both North and South, the American bomber, would not destroy. And that's where you find refuge. And I remember as a child, saw these glimpses all around. So somehow I associate with that very painting. And it had such a profound impact of whatever you don't see clearly. Yet each of those glimpses hover below your subconscious and it lingers and it become alive. Do you know? Even till today. I mean, these are glimpses of things that I feel occasionally become a very major epiphany in one's life. And that was certainly one of the epiphanies.
Had you questioned your ambition to be a designer at all before that? Or was it just in that moment you knew you needed to do something completely different from what you thought you were going to do?
Well, I had a prearranged marriage growing up in Vietnam, and I thought it would be nice to be able to come to America, becoming the Vietnamese version of Mr. Alexander Lieberman one day, to go back and marry the love of my life, so to speak. So it was a kind of artificial construct or a conventional one. The truth is, it never happened, and the last year of my senior year, I began to think about what ways in which I can be more close to my calling. The inner calling is so important. I think I've been neglected that for a while, Richard. Even though I was a very good student, I remember my first year in college, first semester, I took a painting 101 class with a painter named Jane Piper. And it was terrific. First time I ever painted directly from nature. A still life a la Matisse light, which is what she was trying to teach us to see and then reduce what we see into a color palette very similar to Matisse and the school of Paris. And I did well, but that didn't prevent me from my goal to become a successful magazine director one day, commercial director one day. But I remember the last day of the class, he told me, you have a spirit of an artist. And if you ever change your mind, you come to me and let me know. And that was it. After seeing De Kooning, I call her up. And she sent me to the New York Studio School in West Village.
What do you think she meant by saying you have the spirit of an artist? What did she recognize in you that you perhaps had not recognized yourself?
Richard, none of us able to recognize ourselves in our youth. That's why it's important to have others who would recognize it and would be generous enough to say it, to let you know. Sometimes we don't listen. And I certainly didn't listen when Jane said that until I make the connection between my own epiphany confronting the De Kooning's painting. And then everything rushed back. I remember what she's saying. I call her. That's how it happened. She sent me to the New York Studio School, which was the first original Whitney Museum on A Street. And that's how I went to school for a year.
While I was preparing for this, Fong, I read a piece in which you said, I've attempted to emulate Willem de Kooning in many respects. In so doing, I've learned that one of his most remarkable attributes is his complete trust in his own anxiety. What does it mean to trust in one's anxiety as a source of creative fuel?
De Kooning, as you know, has a cryptic sense of humor. I think it was told to me by one of his close friends, the painter, photographer named Rudy Burkhardt. They were walking on the street. A young painter came to them and pointed to De Kooning. Are you Mr. De Kooning? He said, yes, indeed. And he said, how do you like it when everybody's painting like you, sir? And he said, it's not my problem. You know why? And the young man sort of not saying anything. And he said, you could always paint the good De Kooning, but you could never paint the bad ones. Going back to what John Kidd famous reference when he called negative capability in that famous letter that he wrote in defense of poetry. The artists have ability to live with great uncertainty, anxiety, all of it, without having the need to justify through reason. And I think all creative individual must come to reconcile with their own anxiety, because anxiety to me can provide a serious spark of energy if you know how to control it, if you know how to direct it into something, an object of concentration, object of focus.
Could you give an example of a situation where you were able to convert anxiety into fuel?
Yes, I think many, but I can give you one because it happened to be a robust, monumental undertaking. In October 2012, my studio, which was low-lying one, back up the Newton Creek, when Superstorm Sandy hit New York and Brooklyn, it destroyed the 25 years of my work, Richard, along with nearly 40% of the rail archives. I was devastated, but I refused to be depressed because I had experienced similar tragic situation growing up in Vietnam. 2-3 of my home were bombed, you know, from having moved around so many times. You found refuge in occasional happiness, whether reading a book or the beautiful landscape or spending time with my grandparents' home or seeing my cousin, whatnot. You're always able to extract those occasional moments of happiness to counter those anxious moments. So for me, having lost that body of work so profoundly destructive, along with so many artists in the back of the building and hundreds of artist friends I knew whose work was also destroyed by Sandy, because none of us predicted the erosive power of the salt water, Richard, came up from the sea. So the following year, I created one of the biggest shows ever mounted in New York City. It's called Come Together, Surviving Sandy. And that was put together in 2 months. It was 365 artists plus, and it was 100,000 square feet. And it was the most incredible healing exhibition So that's a good instant.
We'll come back a little later to talk about that.
Yeah.
For now, though, Fong, let's hear about the first book on your list, which was Artist in His Studio by Alexander Lieberman.
Well, it's one of those classic books. I grew up in both of my grandparents' home where there was a lot of books. You see a lot of books. I love that book because it was the first time that I get to see these great artists in their natural habitat, their homes, their studios. Picasso, Braque, Léger, Matisse, certainly. There was Giacometti. There's so many great artists at that period, which makes sense to me because during the war, American wasn't allowed to go there to Paris until the war ended. So it makes sense that when the war ended, I think Alexander Lieberman, even though he had working already in Paris in the 30s, so there's a lot of excitement in that book that I love so much because you see where the artists were doing, how they live. And there was an intimate quality to their working space. Lieberman was considered as equivalent of Giorgio Vasari with the camera. And I like the way he writes. That book was essential. I wanted to live in that world one day, if I can create that world one day. And if I don't get to be like Lieberman himself, who later became a painter, became a sculptor, in addition being the artistic director of Condé Nast. And I just love the sophistication of that life.
How old were you when you discovered that book?
Probably, I would say, 7 or 8.
Oh, very young.
Very young, very young, because that book came out in, oh boy, the first edition, I believe, was 1960, because it was inspired by the show he had at the Modern Museum in 59. Where a lot of his photograph was being shown. And I know James Shaw Throby, one of the curators at the time, wrote the introduction for it. But I didn't read English in those days. I just flipping through the pages. And finally, when I came to Philadelphia, of course, I would buy a copy and treasure it. I still have it today. It's an important book for me.
In 1986, Fong, you were enrolled at the New York Studio School, as you mentioned a little earlier, and you were asked to go and collect a painting from the home of the art historian Maya Shapiro. This led to what became a profound relationship with Shapiro and his wife Lillian. You said that you became their adopted Jewish grandson, and that when Maya Shapiro died, that his passing left an impossible void. You also said that without that relationship, you would not have had the strength and the stamina to go on to shape the Brooklyn Rail. And I wonder what it was that enabled you and Maya Shapiro, two people from entirely different backgrounds at completely different places in their lives, to form such a strong bond.
Well, it's one of those miracles of life, isn't it, Richard? Just like you and me meeting now, I think to me, there was something in my Shapiro recognizing myself as when he was at that age, maybe, as an immigrant. I think once you're an immigrant, that would never escape you, even though he came here maybe 3 or 4 years old. But he lived and grew up in Brownsville, which is in Brooklyn, the poorest part of Brooklyn. Because they were so poor, the Shapiro, they couldn't even go to Lower East Side. So that's how poor that family were, that 4 or 5 block of radius in Brownsville. And I think that never escaped him, being poor, being the product of the Great Depression. But also what he recognized in me is probably the spark of curiosity. And I rarely told this story, but I believe I wrote it in What Survived from My Memoir. In the third chapter, where I describe, he inquired about my upbringing in Vietnam. He knew a great deal about the war, and he confessed that since the war ended in 75, he's no longer involved in politics. But then we found a common ground once he asked Lillian to invite me in for tea. I still remember it was September 14, 1986, he invited me for tea, where we began talking about the book, Fear and Trembling, because he said to me, I detect some sadness in you. And I said to Maya and Lillian, I'm okay, since now I'm halfway through Kierkegaard's book, Fear and Trembling, because I'm have terrible difficulty, terrible relationship with my father. And that book really helped me to unfold all this inexplicable tension growing up between my father and myself, and associate referencing Abraham and his son Isaac was so profound for me at the time. And then, of course, Maya got excited. So he went on for like a good hour talking about Kierkegaard, how much he admired his own work, even though he should have tried to defend on the Hegelian side. He's very much a big admirer of Hegel. So it was very interesting to see the great man, Meyer's great intellect, mediate between how much he admired Hegel, but he also had equal admiration for Kierkegaard. So from that point on, it was very important for me, Richard. There's no need to choose side in any side. I already experienced that conflict growing up in Vietnam from members of the family who was so dedicated, devoted to Ho Chi Minh, and those who discover after the Moscow trial, gained disillusionment of the Communist Party. So they were looking for ways for other democratic options.
You just touched on the second book on your list, which is Kierkegaard. Where did you find that? Did somebody give it to you to read? Did you just stumble upon it?
No, not really. I took a philosophy 101 class in college, and I stuck reading philosophy as long as I remember. In fact, even when I was a kid, I always loved philosophical writings, thoughts. So I think philosophy has been with me always. And I think meeting Maya and reading more of it, it just amplified more and more. And I still do it today.
One of your attractions to Maya Shapiro was his connection to the cultural life of New York in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. You've said that one of the reasons you've made the choices you have in your life is because you want to experience the life of a bohemian. In 2021, being an artist has become, for many people, a career. So what does it mean in this moment to be bohemian?
Well, it means a lot of things, Richard. To mean bohemian today would be impossible for young people. The cost of living is very high. And above all, in the academy, they don't teach you that lifestyle. I think since the Vietnam War ended in 75, I think there was a horrible psychological blow to the progressive left, the best of the radical left. I think they gradually moved to the academy. And I think for the next several decades, people found there's actually an actual career that you can undertake in the academy, Richard. If you discipline, if you gain your graduate study and PhD, most likely you might find a teaching job somewhere. And I think my feeling is that by the late 70s, the amplification of specialization became a reality. You need to specialize in a certain field of study, and there's no other time or space in which allow you to read other material or explore other field or discipline. And I believe that one became a reality by the 90s. In addition to the Cold War ended in 91, if you think of that sequence until September 11 in 2001, which gave more power to the right, for sure. I'm thinking in political terms, you know, Richard. The academy had become a business.
If I could ask you to entertain a curriculum that would be filled with the values that you aspired to as a young artist coming up, meeting Maya Shapiro, what would you change? What type of curriculum would you build?
Well, whatever in the rail, Richard, is all there.
I had a feeling you might say that. Yeah.
I mean, when you think about the incredible Black Mountain College, the whole idea of teachers and students working together. The teacher are learning, why are they teaching too? The allowance of cross-pollinate. It's so alive. It's a living organism. Lock Mountain College is a terrific example if you want to think about the most ideal in democratic learning.
You were born in 1964, and as you've said, you grew up in the midst of the Vietnam War. Yet you've also spoken of having a very happy childhood. You were educated at a very good school. You learned to play the guitar. You read books. You had multiple nannies. What was it like to grow up in such privilege while the war was raging outside? And I also wonder if this paradox has had a lasting effect on you.
It's not, Richard, as a defense mechanism. We all entitled to be aware of it or not, but I think at an early age, I was very conscious of it. I was conscious of the fact that I was not like my sibling. I was conscious of the fact that it's not easy to inspire me into a conformist. I was conscious of the fact that in spite of the pressure of family expectation, I won't conform into my parents' wish for me to become whatever they felt I should become. I was conscious of all of that growing up. I was conscious of the war. I was conscious of the privileged background I came from. I also was conscious of friends, many of my friends who came from much poorer background. And I was conscious of having that privileged life until we were sent to labor camp where we didn't have anything. So the duality of life, Richard, have been with me very early on. The greatest teaching about Buddhism is the middle way. It's the best solution to mediate between extremities of life experiences. Rich, poor, violent versus serenity, any kind of condition of conflict, paradoxes. I just felt the early exposure to Buddhist teaching was very important through my grandmother from my paternal side. She had gone through a lot of life suffering on her own. So she was somebody who would take me to Buddhist temple and teach me. I remember as a kid, I always amazed every afternoon from 4 to 5, she would meditate. And her head saved like mine. And one instance, a huge mosquito landed on her head, Richard. And I killed the mosquito. I slapped it. And that didn't wake her up. So the next day, I snuck in because he was wearing a Buddhist robe. So it's very big. So the wallet and the money on the side, it wouldn't touch her body. So I snuck and I stole a few dollars to take my friend to a movie. And that evening, I came home for dinner. And she said to me, next time, ask, don't steal. That stuck with me forever.
Do you think she did feel you slap her on the head when you killed the mosquito?
She was aware of everything, but not moving, being disturbed. That's what we call nirvana, right? Nirvana is the state of being there, but and then not there at all. Isn't that what we try to do in life, Richard?
That's an amazing story. I did want to ask you about your grandmother, because I know that she had an enormous impact on you. You've said that she and Maya Shapiro really are the two people that have had the most profound impact on your life. And one of her aphorisms that you often repeat is that she came to you, I think, when you were about 10. And she said, when you grow up, you will suffer like everyone else, but make sure you suffer the right way. How did she suffer, and how have you incorporated her advice?
She was born from a lower class, at least lower than my grandfather. They were prearranged to be married, and in those days, when you married to a man as a woman, you moved in to the house to live and serve your husband's parents. And that's what she did. And I don't remember the specific, but one instance she told me that she was pregnant before being married. And that was very taboo in a certain social decorum in the middle upper class Vietnamese family household. And so I think she was abused by her in-laws, and her husband, my grandfather, was too coward to protect her, support her. But, you know, she born 10 children.
Wow.
And they all became terrific people in the world. Most of them are teachers. And instead of passing on that agony, she decided that she would remedy it. So she treated all my aunts who married to my uncles with terrific affection and compassion and respect. And to me, that's remarkable. That ability to overcome what once was the most perpetual pain that inflicted on you, and you have the ability to let go, to do the opposite. I was very conscious of that early on, Richard, and I saw her suffering so much.
Fong, let's hear about the third book on your list, which is by Dori Ashton, The New York School, A Cultural Reckoning.
That was a book that I also read in my last semester in the senior year. I believe I read it in 2 days, Richard. I was so captivated by it because what Dori did in that book was to reconstruct the atmosphere, the beginning of the New York culture of intelligentsia, bohemian life, where artists, poets, political activists, downtown New York. That's what make New York equivalent of what Paris once were. I don't think New York was that important until the turn of the century, until these European immigrant flow into Ellis Island, which is tied to Irving Howe's book too, The War of Our Father, you know?
Which we'll talk about a little bit later, yeah.
Yeah, so it's all tied together in some ways. But I believe that book was so important to me, Richard, because I want to come to New York. I want to belong to that culture because he painted an amazing romantic environment, the atmosphere, where the artists hang out, what they were doing during the Great Depression, what their struggle was. And there's a second chapter, I believe it's called Hell. It's not just painting. Because people used to cross-pollinate. They used to talk about all kinds of things, in addition to their social issue and political struggle. And I just love it. I just love it. And it was in black and white. The one I had was Edwin Denby, sitting on the chair right to the edge of the building on 8th Street or 10th Street, taken by Rudy Burkhardt. And that image was so striking to me. I felt like bohemian life is really the life not on the center. The life is not on the mainstream. It's on the edge. I'm interested about things on the edges, the margins. We heard about it for years and years. I think Paris was that way when we read about Montmartre, where Picasso Braque once lived, where Soutine, Utrello, there's many other Modigliani. I mean, they lived on the edge. That was the whole inspiring life that I felt I wanted one day to have the opportunity to live that life. You probably know another great book similarly, also by Dori's friend, Roger Sadek, The Banquet Years.
Yeah.
That's also a great book, you know. And I was lucky, Richard, because I got to know Dori very well, where I would come and have dinner with her almost every week.
What kind of things did you talk about?
All kind of things. I would sit in the chair where Borges once sat, or Rothko once sat, or Philip Guston once sat, or, you know, Harold Rosenberg once sat. It's a small table, like 6 chairs, and I had the pleasure to choose where I want to sit. The whole idea is how to get to know these people so that I'm the middle, the go-between, like the middle way, so I can pull together the wisdom of that older generation and present it as if I'm the baton to the younger one. That's a Brooklyn Rail philosophy, Richard. That's what the rail's about. Because this culture doesn't quite since the end of the Vietnam War, I think it increasingly becoming more divisive, the greater distance they create, not to mention that once the sweeping automatic retirement, once you reach a certain age, they send you immediately to the elderly home center anyway. How do you expect the grandchildren going to spend time with their grandparents? How would you expect the wisdom and the great story, the narrative, so to speak, that they get to hear and remember?
I was alluding to that earlier with my question about Maya Shapiro and your reverence for him going in the door. I don't know how many 20-year-olds today would walk into the house of a 70 or 80 year old art historian and be willing to sit and listen to them talk about Kierkegaard or about anything for an hour or two. I'm also struck by your ability to navigate people with very different ideas, esteemed people, people who have made great careers for themselves, who have very different philosophies and approaches. And it seems to me that one of your goals has been, if not to bring those people together, to bring their ideas together so that they can rub up against each other and the reader can think about how those differing opinions sit together.
Yeah, absolutely. That is the agony in our political life right now, Richard, because the division between left and right without any kind of civilized discourse being mediated in the middle. So the extremity about one to the other is no longer possible because the decorum, language, spoken language, thoughts, articulation of those ideas is being demolished. It's been ripped apart for so long. And I believe that it's hard to think how we can heal ourselves and bring it together, create that platform again. You remember, as much as we disagree with people like Buckley Jr., you know that he's trying to be as thoughtful as possible with his idea. You see his debate with James Bowen, it's a good one. We don't have those forums, those coming together and talk and share idea and talk intelligently, sensitively, and same thing in writing, because all of that is now kept in the academy, I believe, Richard.
If I may, Fong, I want to go back in time to your youth, because you had family members who were involved on both sides of the Vietnam War. Tell us about the atmosphere in your house and how that affected your sense of what was going on in Vietnam at that time.
You know, like anything else, anything that is so intensely political within the family dynamic. And I remember during the Tet Offensive, my maternal grandfather was a devoted communist, and he harbored a lot of communist spies in the basements of his home, and he was caught. And you remember during the Tet Offensive, anyone who gets caught would be publicly executed, just like the famous photograph that one see, the Viet Cong being shot right through his head by the police chief general, remember?
Yes, Eddie Adams photo, yeah.
Eddie Adams, exactly. He was caught, but the one who caught him was his son-in-law with the secret police chief. So he was put in jail for a couple of weeks, get roughed up a bit, and he was released. So he'd been in and out of jail a few times. But that very uncle, as soon as the war ended in 75, he would disappear.
Your uncle disappeared?
Yeah, because the communists came and punished him, and we never saw him again. And that's just one incident. There's many more in the family, north and south dynamic. My nanny was a communist spy.
Who were employed by your grandfather, correct?
Yes, and then my parents, you know.
Did people talk about these things when the family would get together? Did people argue about their political differences and their feelings about the war?
Yeah, once a year they would at the family gathering during Tet, which is New Year. It's a big celebration. Sometimes it's very exciting, Richard. Some of the relatives who failed to be teacher would join the military and became very high-ranking officer. One was lieutenant general or doctor. One was the chief admiral Air Force or something. I can't remember. But they would argue with their siblings, my uncle and aunt. And they would pull out gun and start shooting in the air.
So it got very heated, clearly.
Very heated. They couldn't argue against the academic, the teachers, you know? And they would come to the house by helicopter, which is create a chaos anyway. Such a loud noise and neighborhood would be upset. And that happened every time. It's unbelievable. And my memory as a child was very exciting. wasn't frightening or anything, you know?
In 1976, when you were 12, your family was evicted from Hue and relocated to a farm in the middle of nowhere, essentially. That must have been an enormous upheaval in your life. How did you find out that was going to happen? And did you have time to pack? What did you take with you?
We had time to pack, but not much at that point. Everything we did had to be in one truckload, small truckload. So it was really not even furniture, Richard, just clothes and other necessary belongings. It took 4 days to arrive to Kaibei, which is located in the Delta area. And we were given a small piece of land, and we have to farm rice and build our home out of mud and bamboo, really. We managed to survive for nearly 4 years, actually. It was very difficult, but again, we should never underestimate human resiliency.
What did it feel like when you woke up on that first morning and you realized how very different your life was going to be?
Yes, it was. But at the same time, living in that condition, the pace of life was so different, Richard. Everything was so slow. And you have time to do a lot of other things. Actually, I read more than I ever had in that period. Even though I lost 4 years of high school, I didn't go to high school.
Where did you get books?
Enough books that you can just read it 10 times over. They were sent every time a relative come visit. So we managed to sustain ourselves during that period. What was good about it is that the surveillance is not as robust. So it's allowed my mother to move around and she's able to revisit, reconnect some of her ethnic Chinese friends who at the time was being pushed out. And that's when the whole thing were organized by my mother, where we paid a certain family, the Fishman family, and our ID was made into ethnic Chinese. And then we were able to escape on the boat. But there's no guarantee. Once you're on the sea, if the Coast Guard gets you, you are back into square one and get sent to prison.
And then you went to Malaysia.
Yeah. We were lucky. We were lucky. So lucky.
You were sent to the labor camp to be re-educated. Were you re-educated? Did that experience have lasting implications for the way that you have lived your life?
Well, we've gone to many times in the summer labor camp before that, so we'd experienced the hot labor. But after those summer, when we chose this is what we need to do, to go to re-educational center, and as far as we can, because basically we were left alone then. We just have to survive, Richard. And that's very calculated from my mother's perspective. She knew the farther we can go away from the city, the less the communist regime or official put an eye on us. So it's so far that there were some communist official occasionally come up, but it was not intensely surveillance like it would if you were to live near the city. So I would say that it was hard because you lived this without water and electricity, all the usual modern comfort that we were so accustomed to is no longer available to us. So we have to live off the land, essentially. And that was really fruitful. It taught me a great deal about how to survive. I don't think without that experience, we wouldn't able to do what we did when we landed in Bucks County, Pennsylvania.
Which I want to ask you about in just a minute. But before that, let's hear about your fourth book.
Yeah.
World of Our Fathers, The Journey of the East European Jews and the Life They Found and Made by Irving Howe.
Well, I identify with that book so much, Richard, because Irving Howe painted a beautiful history of how European Jews came to New York. It might have started in 1880, I think, you know. There's several chapters. All the chapters are wonderful. But I think the one that I always identify so much is when he began talking about the beginning of City College, which was very famous in those days, where all the poor Jewish students would go. He was a product of that. I just loved the idea when the allowance of Jewish immigrants who aspired to be intellectuals, aspired to be artists, aspired to be creative, so they were willing to move away from their Jewish upbringing, their background, And I love that idea that so poor in Europe, whether in Ukraine or Kiev or someplace in Poland, and they live, whether like Maya Shapiro in Brownsville or Lower East Side. Maya Shapiro and Lillian Shapiro told me that their home was so small, Richard, where the table, the dining table, have to be utilized accordingly to certain specific hour where they study from certain hours. Certain hour, their mother would make bread. In fact, Maya, his brother Morris, and Mary share the same bedroom. They slept on the love bed. And same thing with Lillian. So that's how poor they were, Richard. And their excitement for culture, I love the word culture in Yiddish, is with the K, culture, was the most essential thing because that's all you got. That's all you got because you don't know where your home tomorrow will be. I deeply identify with that from my own journey, growing up in Vietnam, being a boat person to Malaysia, landed in Pennsylvania, somehow came to New York. It's a journey, Richard, and I don't want to take it for granted.
In 1979, you arrived in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, where you found what you've described as nothing but white people and deer. What did you know about America before you arrived? And how did this compare to what you found in Bucks County?
Well, I knew about America partly because I have aunts and uncle who were here studying. So they would send books home, magazine, certainly records. I grew up listening to Delta Blues already as a child. I listened to Lonnie Johnson, Muddy Waters, certainly Howlin' Wolf. In the meantime, I also was interested listening because my aunt and uncle were listening to French pop music. So I would also listen to François Hardy, Johnny Hallyday, Sylvie Vartan. Of course, I read most of Dumas, a lot of Balzac, for sure, and the classic, like The Red and the Black. So it was very interesting to be caught in the old remnants of the French-dominated culture and the emergence of the American excitement of pop culture. I was aware of both culture. It's just shocking to be landed in Bucks County just because it's not cosmopolitan. And I remember the first film that we saw, we were encouraged. As soon as we landed in Bucks County, the poorer part of Bucks County, we were given a big television by our uncle and aunt, and we were encouraged to watch as much as possible while learning English as a second language. And the first film we saw was Deliverance. That was a very frightening movie. I remember identifying that movie with where we were in Ben Salem, Pennsylvania, in Bucks County. We wouldn't leave home for like a good 2 months.
No canoeing trips.
No. We dare not to walk out at night, you know.
From the fifth book on your list is Spring Essence. And I am not going to be able to pronounce correctly the name of the poet, so perhaps you'll do that for me.
Bo Song He was one of the most amazing poets. I read her work as a child. My grandmother's, both sides, would recite her poems by heart. They have the ability to recite in the old language of Vietnam. It's called Tien Nung. It's no longer available, but I think there's an attempt to bring it alive. They would recite poems hours and hours to no end. So I grew up with her work. She's very subversive. She's very political.
And very erotic as well, right?
Very erotic. Wow, oh wow, erotic. That's the thing. In Vietnam growing up, the poetic was the most political form because you couldn't make pictures, you couldn't paint because the whole country was perpetually ravaged by war. You're constantly on the run. So you couldn't make painting or sculpture. But the most important thing that is you can write poems. Even they destroy your manuscript, you memorize the poem so you can pass it on as an oral tradition.
Was that the case? Her poems were handed down?
Oh, yeah. Yes, absolutely.
So she was writing at the end of the 1700s, early 1800s.
Yes, yeah. It's very important because when John Barbipin translated, I think it was published by Copper Canyon Press in 2000, I immediately went out and bought the book and would read it with pleasure for that whole entire month, really. And as my Vietnamese, the ability to speak has been slightly eroding because I don't use it so much. So it's nice. I think that book was very important. It's just refreshed my memory growing up, memorizing a lot of her poems. And it reminded me also the function of poetry, Richard. It's very powerful.
I want to ask you specifically about that a little bit later. Did your family know, they must have known, that they were reciting these very subversive, erotic poems?
Everyone know, even grandma. Grandma would recite it with a smile, a twinkle on her face. And of course, being a child, you wouldn't know so much about these subtle implications. But you know it was mischievous poems, for sure. And then you discover more.
Your father, Fong, was a history teacher who became a businessman. And you've said that you discovered at a young age a box of his diaries in the attic of your house. What was in those books, and how did that affect your sense of who your father was?
He was an aspiring young intellectual, for sure. He had the most beautiful handwriting. His penmanship is impeccable, very elegant. And he can draw, and he makes sketches of places that he saw or been. And he was teaching. In fact, my name and my other sibling, the three boys, was named after places that he taught. He was aspired to be an artist some sort or intellectual some sort. He took note, impeccable note. He made beautiful drawing. He made beautiful photographs. And then when he got married, and I believe when, I don't know, maybe when my youngest sister was born, he just became a business person, maybe even earlier than that. And whatever decision he made, it was very clear, decisive decision. Like he wouldn't go back. He cut that part of himself completely. So you don't see it in him. I don't know if you ever confronted with such individual in your life, but that was a shock for me.
Did you ever ask him about it?
No, I never dared to. I never dared to. Maybe I have my good chance now. He's 96 to be, and I plan to make a trip to Vietnam to see him with my whole family.
That would be a big moment for you to ask him.
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
Fong, if I may, I want to ask you, it's a big question, but I think it's an important one. In the draft of your memoir, the chapter that survived the flood of Sandy, you said that when you arrived in New York, I didn't want to simply be free, I wanted to become free. What prompted you to make that distinction? And what's the difference between being and becoming?
Huge difference. In the state of being, which is fantastic, like I'm being with you now, we have the pleasure of talking, exchanging all kind of ideas through this conversation here. But becoming is when you're not thinking. Becoming is something that are in the state of unexpected growth. Just no more, no less than you pay a visit to the Metropolitan Museum to see the bust of Homer and Aristotle by Rembrandt. And you are moved by the dramatic lighting in that painting, the chiaroscuro and the gravity of the way that Homer's bust is being rested by his enormous hand by Aristotle. And you are captivated by that space, that dark space, and the illuminating light elevate the dignity of the two philosophers sort of coming together. One is dead, one is alive. But Rembrandt painted that relatively late in his life. And we know how tragic his life was. He lost his son, both of his wife died, his two sons died, and then he went bankrupt. And he made those pictures. It could apply to some artists who didn't have to suffer like Rembrandt, you know. But me didn't suffer much, apart from the fact that he didn't sell so many paintings, because he did not make many. But it's irrelevant, right, Richard? You go there and every time you look at Vermeer or Rembrandt, we always see something else in it that we didn't see from the previous visit. That's, to me, a good example of becoming.
Let's hear about your next book, Fong, number 6, Democracy in America by Alexis de Tocqueville.
I read it in passing, but never in one complete sitting until Trump got elected. And certainly when he came to television in the afternoon on Monday, March 16, 2020, and announced the 15 days quarantine. Most of us knew that he did not even know what that word meant, where it came from. And then he had the audacity and arrogance use that phrase that we all hated so much, social distancing. I was very, very upset because as a refugee, we fled from the tyranny of the Communist Party in Vietnam. And I felt like we potentially have an equivalent to some dictator. So we created the social environment lunchtime conversation immediately the next day. And we were being walked through how Zoom as a new technology could function. Because I told my team, whatever Trump is doing, he's very good with using speed as power. Speed as power to destroy, as power to create chaos, as power to amplify fear and anxiety. And when he say the word social distancing, I understood that he doesn't want us to get together psychologically. If he say physical distancing, that would be a different story, wouldn't it? So in the course of that, I began reading Tocqueville, Democracy in America, because I wanted to understand how it all began. How did a Frenchman who wrote this influential book, it's so extraordinary that he asked to be sent here to study prison system for the course of 9 months, which is traveled greatly throughout America in order to take notes and observe. And it's very interesting. He immediately associate the failure of the French Revolution, being that he came from noble background, the Tocqueville, the very famous family from Normandy. He talked about how essentially most of his members of the family, their head were cut off by the French Revolution. What is the French Revolution? Think about this for a minute. We forgot. They were mostly comprised by working class, rural poor from the countryside, where during the course of the Industrial Revolution, machine was taken over. So they migrated to the city and there's no job for them. And they were inspired by the American Revolution. But once they overturned the government, they did not know how to govern, you know, Richard. That's what he learned. But he was trying to mediate that experience and apply it to what he's observed about America. None of those people who came here had that noble background. They were not aristocratic. He was interested in the possibility of democratic experiment, having 50% chance of the power lean toward the tyranny of the majority, and the other 50% lean toward the tyranny of the minority. How do you balance that? It's so interesting to me to have read it and realize it's a very fragile state of affair. I don't remember, it could have been in chapter 23 or something, where he mentioned Machiavelli, the prince, and he believed that the prince was the first book. It was a warning of modernity, so to speak. In other words, if you were a prince, a crown prince, you could no longer sit back and not involve in social affair. You have to find way to engage what's going on the street. You have to find way in which to mediate and have a certain set of language to talk with all kinds of people. It's not just the rule of the monarchy that removed from social life. So he talked about the 50 chance of between the two. And throughout the course of reading it, I discover the whole entire democratic ideals of what democracy meant for different people, what it meant for Thoreau, what it meant for Emerson, and what it meant for Walt Whitman, and what it meant for even John Dewey, for example. I've been reading John Dewey a lot lately because I'm interested in the idea of how to mobilize the power and the accessibility of education in the art and humanities and sciences and not make it into the function that associate with the elites. I'm interested very much in that at the moment because I felt it's been kept in the academy for so long, Richard, and the academy became a machine, a business enterprise. And the distribution of labor is really lopsided. profoundly so. We don't even know how to appreciate the people who fix our car. Or there's such a thing where you go to school for that. I think that during the debate between Hillary and Trump, I was horrified when she called the people in between America, when she refused to go to Wisconsin, didn't need to go to Pennsylvania and Wyoming, and called the people in between the East Coast and the West Coast the deplorable. I was horrified. I knew immediately it had to change. This whole idea of talking the way these lefty people have talked, with such incredible professorial style speaking. So the extremity is not in well-balanced, Richard. It's exactly what Tocqueville was talking about. It's very fragile. It had to balance. You have to bring the two very close to each other, not separate. Because the four that is separate in space in between, the greater imbalance it becomes. And I see that during the years, the decades that I've been in America, I see it increasingly so. And through the course of being as a publisher on the rail and having the privilege to interview our friend, the great intellectual, artist, thinker, I realize that the function of the rail is to make it free so that everyone who aspires to read, it's here it is. I think there's a reason why the cross-pollination between one field to the other is beginning to merge, what I call spillover readership, Richard. What you're doing is spillover, cross-pollinated undertaking as an artistic oeuvre. I think we need to have that commitment, and we need to make that commitment to intellectual artistic practices that made it not as associating with elite, with a certain kind of cultural privileges. And I believe I have faith. If every city have an equivalent like the rail, we might have a good chance to push younger people to think differently. I really think that.
You've spoken, Fong, often of embracing the mystery that comes with being an artist. You've said specifically, I don't understand all of it. Imperfection is something I embrace. Failure, I embrace. How would you define failure? And what does it mean in a culture that's increasingly intolerant of failure to embrace it?
Well, you know how it is. To me, failure is so essential because when you fail, you should fail big. You shouldn't fail small. Failing small is like a mosquito bite. It doesn't awaken you. It's not a life-changing situation. It has to be like an accident, you know? Walking street and somebody hit you. I feel the unexpectation of those failures is so important. I can share with you one, being that the rail coup d'etat 3.5 years ago, that was an immense failure. I nearly lost the rail. The failure is very simple. I was falling asleep at the wheel. I was not being mindful of how much I have invested in the rail and how much I have neglected my relationship with certain people and how much I was not mindful of also aspects of bureaucracy, a certain bureaucracy that you need to be mindful of. And I wasn't at all that way.
Fong, let's hear about the seventh book on your list, which is Worldview in Painting, Art and Society by Maya Shapiro.
Well, I love that book because it's organized by Maya's widow, Dr. Lillian Milgram Shapiro, who was a very distinguished doctor. After Maya passed away in 1996, she lived until 2006 at the age of 104. So the last 10 years of her life, she put together at least four of Maya's books. It's amazing. And that was one of the books that she put together. It comprised so many of his early writing concerning to social and political landscape of America at the time. Everything had to do with artists, really. I love it because it shared a great deal of his early commitment in social function of art. Study of art as a humanistic art and social base and under socialism, the value of modern art, I remember. He even talked about the future of the art. And he talked about the profession of the artist. And of course, the most important is the responsibility of the artist. And it's just terrific. There's an essay in there, I think it might be the last, where he spoke passionately about the fine arts and the unity of mankind. And I think that very last essay touched me very deeply, because in his own upbringing during the 30s, where all these aspiring intellectuals and artists colliding with the European immigré, with the writers or artists like Max Ernst, for example, Duchamp came also. A lot of surrealists were here. Marta was here, Kirk Seligman was here, André Breton was here also. So you can imagine that collision between the East Village, which is filled of artist studio, and the West Village, which is basically European and a lot of young aspiring American intellectual, they single-handedly created the most exciting period leading to almost as less as it's long till the end of the Vietnam War, really, when you think of it. So that's a long run, even though I think the 60s changed the course of a great deal. I know, we know, that in the 50s, there was a terrible pressure under McCarthy repressive. I would say the House of Un-American Activity were created in order to look for those to be blacklisted.
Fong, I'm interested in the nature of your conversation with Maya Shapiro. You've spoken about him earlier in our discussion, but I wonder if there are any of his ideas, any one idea, for instance, that's really foundational for you. And then also conversely, whether there are ideas of his that you fundamentally disagree with, and also whether you spoke about those things with him.
I wouldn't dare to disagree with Maya Shapiro. I don't think a lot of people would anyway, so I'm not the first. It's not that he appeared to be disagreeable. He was a very gentle person. He got excited about his idea, and one of his greatest gifts, I never attended a live lecture, but I listened to many of recorded lecture, all of which are now at the archive at Columbia University, where his office is still under his name there, preserved for graduate and PhD students go there and browse through and research and whatnot. I think it's the way in which his worldview on art as a unification of all the creative activities. I remember super clearly, must have been one of his great lecture on philosophy and worldview and painting, which that book is sort of titled after, Worldview and Painting, Art and Society. He quoted Giordano Bruno, one of my favorite poet and thinker, who was burned at stake in Rome by the Catholic Church sometime in January in 1600. He say, and I memorized this ever since that I talked to Meyer, let's see if I can still remember it. He say, the first and chief painter is the liveliness of fantasy. The first and chief poet is enthusiasm. The philosophers are, in a certain sense, painters. The poets are painters and philosophers. The painters are philosophers and poets. Two poets, painters, and philosophers love each other and admire each other mutually. He is no philosopher who does not poetize and paint. Therefore, it is said, not without reason, to understand is to contemplate the figures of our fantasy. He is no painter who does not, in a certain sense, poetize and think. And without a certain thinking and painting, no one is a poet.
It's really beautiful.
That's it. That's the philosophy of the Real and Fong Bui.
And that leads perfectly to my next question, because in April of this year, you wrote a stirring argument for the importance of poetry. You said, poetry has always been the most honest, the most penetrating and truthful revelation of our greatest vulnerability, of our most intense fear, or of our most inexplicably deep human emotion that cannot be expressed in mere description through the domains of prose fiction, journalistic writing, or any other kind of writing otherwise. So you've elevated poetry to the highest possible echelon. What is it that poetry provides that other things cannot? And why do you think more people don't turn to it for inspiration and solace?
Well, I mean, no one pay a poet to be a poet. That's one thing. No one does that, Richard. And secondly, growing up in Vietnam, where poetry is a political weapon, because you can take it with you anywhere if you know how to memorize the poem that was important to you. And as a kid, I did that through having memorized very important poem and was taught very, very fervently by my grandparents, particularly, more so than my parents, because they lived through that period growing up during the French colonization. And they would remember poems that was handed down to them from their grandparents who have gone through the Chinese domination. And so I grew up with that awareness, and I realized it's cultural to a lot of culture that have to deal with oppression by other culture. That's the political dimension. The other dimension is the aura of beauty, Richard, through which language can be modified, can be structured, can be made. So the poet was super conscious of that. Even in the most dire situation, there's no even a pen or paper to write their poem on. So they would dictate in their own head, memory, and they revise it in their mind. To me, that is so beautiful. It's very hard to articulate that similar productive birth of images if you don't have the pen or paper like the way artists need to do, or writer. I think the poet can be the most economically simple and the purest form of creation, if you know what I mean.
We spoke a little bit earlier about the book Spring Essence, the fact that those poems were handed down orally, which is an extension, I think, of what you just spoke about.
Yeah, to me, it's very important to have that clear in our mind, how we depend on the tradition of the poetics to protect, to enrich our language, not just English languages, but world languages. It drives me insane why a country like U.S. is not that supportive. I mean, they're all kind of poetry community, and yet so many of those community are really well kept in the academy. It's not quite on the street. It's not quite in the underserved community where it needs most.
Fong, the last book on your list is Six Memos for the Next Millennium by Italo Calvino.
Yes. Again, it's a poetic literary proposal. Not long ago, a few hours ago, my assistant, Gal McKeever, was reading a beautiful poem by W.H. Auden about suffering. The old master's never wrong. Remember that beautiful line, the opening two lines? And I was telling him what we just talked now. I recited to him the beautiful Rumi poem. It's called Eating Poetry. All those poems should be rehearse and memorize on the toilet when you're in the bathroom. That's exactly where my home, the bathroom, is filled of poetry books, Richard. And on the toilet, there's a sign that says, please read a poem while you're here. There's short poem, there's long poem, and there's mid-sized poem, and there's epic poems. It all depends how long you're going to be sitting there. So that's where I memorize most of my poem.
So what was it about the Calvino when you first read it has made it such an important book for you?
Well, I always love Calvino's way of writing in any case. I love way his poetic mind and deployment of metaphor. Of course, I think that whole lecture was Charles Eliot Norton lectureship. The whole series is very beautiful and important. I love it because it's almost like a summation of his own life as a novelist. His use of myth and Terence story. You know, Richard, Terence story is a big deal. Creating a story is a huge deal in our life. What is your story? What is my story? What drives me insane is that the right have such a clear story, strong story. Jobs have been taken away from rural, working class, poor. A lot of people like us in the city don't see these people. We don't have any interaction with these people. So that's one of the great stories, you know. Even though it's nostalgically dangerous, the left have no idea. They just repudiate by saying, but where's your facts? It drives me insane. I wrote in my editorial, fact is really uninteresting. That's not interesting at all. You can Google what fact, what year, the day, or whatever event took place, and then even compel Conway to come and give them another round of aggressive attack. What about alternative fact? That's what we do to you guys. So it drives me insane. that we don't understand. Not we. I'm not neither left or right at this point. Trying to figure out how I'm interested in creating a cohesive bond that maintains the balance. It has to be balanced where democracy lies. One is stronger than the other. It's a disaster, Richard. But to get back to Calvino, when I read it, it just exactly how I would like to see my life to be. It uses so many different metaphors. He talked about likeness. And it's hard to forget once you read it. You're like, oh, yes, absolutely. Why didn't I think of it? It was apparent that Perseus was wise. He knew the previous victim to Medusa, who looked at her gaze and turned to stone. So in order to prevent that happen to him, he went to the goddess of wisdom, Athena, to borrow the seal, to have the shield with him. He was able to see her image as a reflection on the seal. That's how he's able to slay her head off. So that's a very interesting way of looking at life. Why would you want to look at life directly all the time? Sometimes it's important to look as a second reflective of life. The mirror, that means thinking, that means contemplating, like conceptually too. I think we make a terrible mistake in our lives sometimes by dealing directly what in front of us and not able to think through and able to create alternative facts. No, I mean alternative narrative. So all of these things create for a usefulness. And I think in Calvino's sense, he was able to construct such episodes, various chapters in his life. And you can see that throughout his novels, one by one. Maybe not very specifically, but definitely out of that structure, who is able to look at life in his own lens as a novelist very, very specifically. There's a chapter in there on multiplicity, which is super beautiful also. Remember?
I do. I love that essay, yeah.
I love it too, exactly. And you know, when you even think about likeness, Richard, when you think about Pegasus, it represents triumphant likeness and everything else, beauty. But it's actually born out of Medusa's blood when it dripped onto the earth. So everything have a mirror opposite. It's so fascinating to me. I love that. I think if we can create an alternative way of looking at life through mirroring it or reflection, it's just another mobilization, deployment of the other self, which is the dualism in each of us. That's why I admire the whole lecture. So I don't think he finished the last one. So in fact, it's only five.
Correct. Yes.
Yeah.
That's right. He died before.
That's right.
Fong, you spoke earlier in our conversation about the destruction of 25 years of your work as a result of Hurricane Sandy and then the enormous exhibition that emerged from that. Most people, those who haven't experienced such a disaster, probably can't even imagine what that would be like. How did you pick yourself up, find the energy to build again? And also, I wonder if there was a kind of freedom that came with the loss and the idea of beginning all over again.
It's hard to describe because I'm not so sure that it would apply to the rest of my siblings who had experienced the same experience that I had growing up in Vietnam, going through the war, labor camp experience, come to America, get stuck in the most impoverished, uncultured part of Bucks County. They all turn out very terrific human beings, doctor and lawyer and whatnot, very practical people. It's hard to describe why I was a little bit different than the rest. I think it had to do with how my grandmother gave me such confidence as a child, Richard. I love my grandmother, who gone through terrible, extreme suffering. And yet she decided early on that she will not let suffering dictate her life. It was an incredible willful act. And in order to balance that willful act, she meditated every day, whether Buddhism really helped her to overcome those grief and sorrow. She was able to substitute all of that with the opposite, which is generosity. She was very famous in that hamlet, that village outside of Hue. She helped so many people out with financial support, give them wisdom. Mostly when people got married, she often give them money for their honeymoon and whatnot. So I had the privilege growing up with her, and I can stay with her any weekend I want to or the summer. So I slept in the same bed with grandma, and she told me a wonderful story. She lived through story, and I want to do the same. And I think the most memorable being a child, no more than 4 or 5 years old, I think I have a skill in drawing things. A lot of epic historical battle in early Vietnamese history. I used to make drawings, you know, of those battles on the floor of her living room. And she was so proud of me, Richard, that I was able to do that from memory. And then she would invite her friends over for tea and then gave me such an amazing support and give me money to the tail end of it so I can take my friends out to movie and whatnot. I've been doing that from when I was 4 or 5 years old until, I guess, the end of the war. She died in 1996, so pretty soon after the war ended. So that's really create that excitement. All you need is just one person support you. And then, you know, some point in your life, certainly in my case, as soon as I set foot in America, I wanted to find those people like my grandmother.
In 2011, you returned to Vietnam for the first time and installed a work titled To Ho Chi Minh With Love. What did you feel as you landed in Vietnam after an interval of over 30 years?
It was very emotional. I went with a terrific Vietnamese friend, artist named Thomas Vu, professor of Columbia University, one of the few Vietnamese in the art world that I know of. And we were invited to go back and have two simultaneous shows at Sen Art, which is a nonprofit created by three Vietnamese and one American who came to this country. They were the one who invited us. Thomas brought a lot of work that he had been working through the theme of dystopian, you know, collision between technology and nature. Very interesting artist. His vision is very compelling. But whereas mine were simply about how to invite the local artists, poets, writers, musicians to bring their own work. And that would be my own work. It was like my first social environment, really, to bring the whole community together and create the constellation of what was already there, already made available. All I need to do is just to install it in a way that have a kind of harmonic unity. I think myself as a conductor, if you know what I mean, Richard, those are wonderful instruments. There's no hierarchy when a poet bring a manuscript of a poem or a sculptor bring a huge sculpture. To me, they're just similar. And all I have to do is just put into some form of cohesion, musical cohesion, and have a performance. The opening was a performance. In fact, one of the artists worked mostly in glass as medium. I was able to encourage her to lay a grid, a tile of glass on the floor, glued to the floor temporarily. So at the opening, when people walk in, they tiptoe because it cracks. So it slowed down the process. They had to walk gingerly, and they were able to look at the works of art at slower pace. And it was fantastic. We have an incredible opening.
Did you feel like you were coming home, or did it feel, after 30 years, unrecognizable in a way?
It was unrecognizable. The food was not as good as I remember.
Well, you didn't have grandma's cooking.
They didn't have grandma cooking, and it became much more westernized, and there's therefore a lot of food was catered for tourism. You had to cook with love, so that's what lacking. So that part of it was terribly disappointing. But other than that, it was coming home. I feel very emotional, as I do today. I always think, who the hell am I? Am I 1 foot in Vietnam still? The other foot is here in New York, but you know, New York is not America. And should I understand America? Should I be compelled to understand America? Because it is my country. It's too easy to say, I'm a New Yorker. It's a very elitist thing to say. I want to understand what it's like for me to potentially to become American too, not just New Yorker. I'm committed, Richard, to support and strengthen the fragility of this democracy.
At the end of each interview, I ask my guests to read a selection from one of the books they've chosen. Fong, what are you going to read for us today?
Dori Aston is very short, from the New York School of Cultural Reckoning. And I will read you her author's note. My favorite philosopher is Gaston Bachelard. I like particularly his unbounded contempt for those who, like the psychoanalyst, try to explain the flower by the fertilizer. Knowing about an artist's ambience does not explain his work. In this book, I'm not dealing with works of art, as I have in my other writings. Rather, I have pursued the problems that cultural historians have always raised in the hope of answering, at least particularly, partially, a simple question that occurred to me years ago. Why did painting take such a long time to make its force known in American culture? In trying to answer that question for myself, I have written a book that is not about art, nor about artists individually, but about artists in American society. It is, if you like, a close scrutiny of the components of the fertilizer, which undeniably have something to do with the flower. Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah, lovely.
Yeah.
Lovely. Phong Bui, thank you so much for speaking with me. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you for having me on your program, Richard. I'm delighted to come back anytime in the next 20 years, if you like.
Okay. But we'll do it. We'll do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. This has been Acts and Facts. I'm Richard Croft. My thanks to Charles Curtis for allowing me to use Captain Hume's Galliard by Tobias Hume as the theme music for this podcast.